Hey, good afternoon or good evening, and welcome to our regular Thursday lecture series. This is actually our final lecture of the semester of what's been a very lively and interesting and diverse program that we've had. However, there are some additional curriculum-related activities this semester. There's a lot of them, so yeah. Bear with me. So tomorrow, Friday, is the official opening of the Lands in Limbo exhibition, which we're going to hear about from its author today. And it'll be at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. The opening ceremony, I guess, will take place from reception from 6 to 9 p.m. So I advise you to come, bring your friends, tell your friends about it. It should be a great opportunity to have a first glance at the actual photos, of which we'll see some images today. Saturday, then, is the final weekend of the Polish Film Festival. So if you're interested in Polish film, there's postcards in the back with information about this weekend's showings. On Sunday, there's a concert by the UW-Madison Russian Folk Orchestra. It'll be at the Olbrich Botanical Gardens, 2 to 3 p.m. So, lots of, you can go see a Polish movie or go see the photo exhibit tomorrow, Polish movie on Saturday, Russian Folk Orchestra Sunday. And then on Monday, if you still have energy, there's a film called The Essence of Life by Anna Ferens at the Marquee Theater at 7 p.m. On Tuesday, there's a film called And the Beggar's Opera. Yeah, so are these a part of the Polish Film Festival?
No, the Tuesday thing is the end of the Václav Havel series.
Okay, thanks for clarifying. So that's at 4 p.m. at 206 Ingram. And if you didn't write down all those details and interested, then there's information in the back on your way out. Our lecture series will resume in the spring semester. I always wonder why they call it the spring semester, because it starts January. January 29th will be our first lecture with a talk by our political science PhD student, Kyle Marquardt. So finally, on to today's speaker. It's a pleasure to welcome Narayan Mahon, to campus. He's a Madison-based award-winning photographer, and his editorial work has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, Virginia Quarterly Review, The Economist, ESPN Magazine, The Guardian, New York Times, The New Yorker, Times of London, 24, Focus, a German magazine, and Powerhouse magazine, among many other national and international publications. So a wide variety of venues. Most recently, he was the winner of American Photography 30, Magenta Foundation's Flash Forward, Emerging Photographers, in 2009. He was a finalist for the International Reporting Project Fellowship at Johns Hopkins University and a grant recipient of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting for his work in Somaliland. He holds a master's degree in photojournalism from Syracuse University's Newhouse School of Public Communications. And he has a bachelor's degree in international studies from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. His exhibition, Lands in Limbo, opens tomorrow at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, as I mentioned. And we welcome him to Creekit today to give us a sneak preview. So we're going to be the first ones to get a glimpse of this wonderful exhibition. So please welcome.
All right, thanks for having me. So just as a side note about the show, tomorrow is the opening. The museum does this thing on Fridays, and there's like food and drinks and stuff, but it costs like $10. And then Saturday starts the opening for free for everybody until March. So, if you can't make it tomorrow or want to save $10, you can see all the pictures for free all the way until March. So there's that note. Like you said, I started really this project before I was a photographer when I was studying international studies at UNC Charlotte. And I focused on Latin American in Latin America and in Eastern European studies. And I had studied abroad in Poland, in Krakow. And on one of the breaks, I took a trip to Ukraine. And this was just after the Orange Revolution and all of that. And I took a train back from Odessa to Moldova. And I passed through some weird place, Transnistria, and I got shaken down for everything I had in my wallet, and I was like, well, you don't take Visa, you know, at the border, because they just wanted some money from me. So that kind of started, you know, I just thought, what the hell kind of place is this? You know, where am I going here? You know, not that corruption is so unheard of in Eastern Europe or elsewhere. I've lost a lot of packs of gum to border guards in Central Asia and all over, but it really actually was the only time I've been taken for actual money at a border. But that kind of started my curiosity into this idea of a de facto state. I had never really come across that situation of, or even heard of, a country not being a real country. So that began my fascination with it. And then following, I went back to the States, came back to UNC Charlotte, and I was all ready to get ready to do a GRE and, you know, apply for graduate schools for international relations. But I, you know, at the same time, I was just kind of realizing that I really enjoyed photography and exploring these issues that I was, you know, very interested in through international studies, but exploring those through photography. And so I decided to go to school for photojournalism instead. There we go, okay. Just so something's up there. So I applied, you know, so I went to graduate school for photography at Syracuse University. And when I applied for graduate school, and having never taken a photography class before, I kind of had to make my written application, you know, sound pretty good, because my photographic portfolio was lacking at the time. But I said, this is the project I want to work on. I want to do a project about unrecognized countries, and I was really interested in exploring this world of de facto states and trying to see and capture visually or document visually the issues that they face and what it's like to be in a place like that. Like in Abkhazia, and I don't know who's heard of Abkhazia. Everybody. And that's the first, you know, that's one nice thing here is that I don't have to explain exactly where it is and then explain the country from which it broke away from and where that is. So it is nice that people have heard of these places. So yeah, this is Abkhazia. And you know, when I started this project, Abkhazia was recognized by zero countries, which was a requirement I made for myself for this project, was that the countries that I photograph for this, for Lands in Limbo, would be recognized by no other country. So when I started shooting this in 2006, Abkhazia was recognized by no one, because Georgia and Russia hadn't had their war yet, and after that war in 2008, then Russia recognized Abkhazia and got a few other countries on board, like Venezuela and Nicaragua and a couple Micronesian islands, who have since rescinded their recognition. So that wasn't really a full-hearted support of the Abkhaz people or their independence. It was much more of a geopolitical play that Russia was doing, more of a finger in the eye of Georgia than anything else. But when I was there, even at the time that Russia wasn't recognizing them, they were giving out passports to Abkhazians. So even then they were, you know, kind of making some play there, and now that's even coming up as an issue. So I photographed five unrecognized countries, Abkhazia, Nagorno-Karabakh, and Transnistria, and then also Somaliland and Northern Cyprus. Northern Cyprus is probably the first of these countries to declare independence but not be recognized by any other country. And there were some others that I had thought about photographing, such as Western Sahara, but they were recognized by nearly 50 other countries. So I focused on these five because they are recognized by no other. And if anyone has any questions during this, like, don't wait to the end.
Just an animal, or is that a cow?
That's a cow, yeah. So, you know, one thing, like in Abkhazia, when Abkhazia was part of the Republic of Georgia for that short time following the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, well, and before then it was a semi-autonomous republic during the Soviet Union times. But, you know, the Abkhaz were never had a majority, right? They were never more than 50% of Abkhazia. And so to make Abkhazia for Abkhaz, you know, for the Abkhaz, a lot of people had to leave because now it is a majority. And so what was left was a lot of emptiness. There's a lot of towns that are like ghost towns or these large Soviet-style apartment blocks, you know, that used to have, you know, thousands of people, now have, you know, maybe a dozen. So that's one thing I looked at. I tried to capture, because I was looking for signs of loss, signs of who's not there anymore. And, you know, as you guys know about the Caucasus, it's this, you know, this mosaic of ethnicities. So what used to be a lot of Maghrelians and Armenians and ethnic Greeks, Turks, they're no longer there. So all that's left are ethnic Abkhaz. So, you know, in this town, this small town, there were some of these apartment blocks that were just virtually empty, with, you know, minus a few families that still live there. So here's a cow grazing and a couple residents.
Can I ask a question about
yeah.
the residents? Are you interacting with folks as you're taking pictures, or do you try to just stay out of the road?
I do. I interact some. On these early trips, my budget was very limited, and my Russian knowledge was almost, my Russian language skills were almost as limited. So, you know, I tried to get around as best as I could on my own, and in some cases I would hire a translator to come with me to some places, and in those times I would have much better interactions. But otherwise, I'm really just kind of looking for images that speak to some issues I want to address. And, you know, some of those issues in these countries are like isolation, you know, identity. How does a breakaway country or a country that's not recognized by any other country identify themselves? Or what are those signs of identity? How does isolation from the international community or the rest of the world manifest itself? And sometimes that's very vague and hard to tell the difference, especially if you're familiar with imagery from the former Soviet Union and that area, that, you know, this could easily be Azerbaijan, you know. It's hard to tell sometimes, but, And one thing, you know, that was very clear was the lack of resources in these countries that isn't in, you know, that isn't experienced necessarily in Georgia. And the project isn't supposed to be a compare and contrast. It's not a look at Abkhazia versus Georgia, you know. But the situation of Abkhazia is that they have nothing. They don't have any money to repair anything. So all those scars or pockmarks from from mortars and guns and are still there. And so it's really hard to move on for these countries when they're, you know, every day they're seeing that every day they drive down, you know, in the bus down the road and they're weaving around, you know, around mortar holes in the highway. And, you know, that isn't something that's experienced in these other countries. And so that's one thing I had noticed too. And just, yeah, you know, I describe these places as looking like just as decay, you know. On the Black Sea, Abkhazia used to be kind of a great resort area in the Soviet Union, and now it's just these rusting hulls and ships on the sea. And yeah, it's kind of a, you know, a paradise lost. You know, so one thing I really tried to look for are just those signs of emptiness, you know, of you know, so what used to have been a really beautiful theater, you know, is just nothing but empty coat hooks. And yeah, and a little memorial on the roadside that you'd see a lot of those in Abkhazia.
Is that a restaurant or?
Yeah, that's an old like restaurant, discotheque kind of place. This is in the capital, Sukhumi, or Sukhum, depending on whether you want to use Georgian or Abkhazia. But yeah, it used to be a real destination for Russians to go to. And when they announced the Olympics were going to be in Sochi, people in Abkhazia just thought, like, this is going to be this huge boom, you know, like the second coming of Abkhazia. Like they were going to get this huge flood of investment to rebuild the hotels, and people were going to be coming there from all over the world because they're only 20 kilometers or so, you know, from you know, Sochi's so close, yeah, 20 kilometers I think from the border with Abkhazia. But then that never came, and Russia actually just closed the border to Abkhazia during the Olympics. And I think they, yeah, I would imagine they felt pretty bummed out about that. Yeah. You know, old playgrounds. You know, one thing I looked for was kind of signs of what youth could do there. There's so few jobs. You know, there's no companies going to Abkhazia to open up a factory, right? Because there's a lot of issues around, well, you know, a company from the U.S. to open up a factory in Abkhazia would be pretty problematic, not knowing also what government could control it later, you know, in the near future. And, so there really isn't much for anybody to do. Like, unemployment rates are very high. A little bit of home life. They had been writing poetry on the walls, which was really kind of beautiful. And of course, the Russian peacekeepers in Abkhazia, because they're completely impartial there. You know, it's kind of funny because they just occupy the exact same military bases that they had during the Soviet times. So they just kind of move back, and it's this joke of a peacekeeping force, really. And yeah, and you know, some people worry or talk that Abkhazia could be the next Crimea around there. And certainly, you know, that's part of Georgia's paranoia. And it's not, I don't think it's so far from reality or a possibility. You know, again, that once great place, like, you know, it's got palm trees and it used to be these, you know, grand hotels and beautiful beach and you know, now it's just the hotel, you know, the, yeah, Destinacia, Abkhazia. Outside of the old parliament, you know, what, I look for a lot of just metaphors because I'm trying to photograph these very unvisual things, you know. But I find a great metaphor in a broken down Lada in front of the, you know, in front of the old parliament or Supreme Soviet. One thing I wanted to look at was how does a de facto state kind of operate as a state? You know, these things that we expect states to do for citizens, you know, whether it's some type of healthcare or transportation or even just trash pickup, you know. The only country of these five that had just basic trash pickup was Northern Cyprus. I saw it and I was blown away. I was like, oh my God, there's a trash man. You know, it's like the most basic thing, but, you know, in these countries, there's none of that. I mean, again, that, yeah, it's like that in a lot of places, of course, too, but to be able to provide that very simple service is beyond, you know, possibilities in Abkhazia or in Somaliland. And here we are at a hospital. They have a big problem with TB, with tuberculosis. And here, actually, they have help from the Doctors Without Borders that do some advising and stuff. And there aren't a lot of international organizations, non-governmental organizations that do anything in any of these places, because it's very problematic with establishing those connections for logistics when you know there isn't a government that is recognized that you can actually deal with. So, you know, what, even, you know, for instance, in Nagorno-Karabakh, the only international organization that was operating there was Halo Trust, which was a landmine removal, and they were in Abkhazia as well. You know, and Azerbaijan was like freaking out over it because they thought they're just spies from England that are, you know, trying to put landmines instead of remove them. So just those very simple things that a lot of underdeveloped countries kind of rely on, being, you know, international aid and non-governmental organizations that can help with, you know, healthcare and these things. It's sparse there. You know, like I said, looking for these visuals of national identity, you know, the Abkhaz flag, which is actually probably my favorite visa in my passport is the Abkhaz visa, and it's got the hand. It's really pretty. But, you know, just that they require you to have a visa is its own interesting thing. Abkhazia is a beautiful country. It's in the mountains. This is a man I encountered living on a very small island off of the Black Sea, like in a slough almost. And he was just perfect because he just lived by himself on this little tiny island out there with nobody else around, and he had worms in his arm and he was burning them with his cigarette and then putting some sort of ointment over them. But he was there with these his missiles and his Kalashnikov, you know, and he had fought for George, for Abkhazia, you know, and he's ready to fight again, and he's just out there on his own, and Abkhazia is just out there on their own too. You know, again, that emptiness. You know, imagine living in this apartment building and there's only three families in there, and you can wander around and there's still the mail that people left behind, photographs that people left behind, and it's a little haunting, because
as you wandered around taking all these potentially embarrassing pictures, was there anybody who took notice?
Yeah, well, so, you know, for instance, in Abkhazia, I registered with the state press agency because I'm not there to do anything clandestinely. You know, I'm an open book. I say this is what I'm doing. This is, you know, I'm just interested.
You're endangered that somebody might in fact attack you as kind of like an Abkhaz nationalist might feel offended, perhaps, or something.
I suppose. You know, I think most, well, you know, in the former Soviet Union area, there's such a heavy culture of paranoia that it doesn't really matter. I'm a foreigner anyways. They don't really trust me. Like, I think, you know, they weren't concerned that I was going to make them look bad, more that I was like a spy who speaks really poor Russian, you know. Like, it was just always befuddling because I thought, if I'm going to be a spy, I'm going to speak like really awesome Russian, right? And you know, I'd gotten picked up like in Abkhazia like three times in one day in this little town, you know, that's like half abandoned, or three quarters abandoned, and you know, it's like I'm just walking around. There's really nothing special going on for me to see. But I didn't really encounter anybody who was worried that I was going to show them in a negative light. And my intention isn't to show anything in a negative light. You know, whether this is embarrassing for them or not, I don't know. It's reality. It's what they see every day. And, you know, I think there is a certain amount of introspection there where they do kind of wonder whether it was all worth it and what they've lost, and you know, and they miss the people that used to live there. Now this is not in Abkhazia anymore. Anyone can recognize the writing. Anyone? Armenian.
Yes.
So it's in Nagorno-Karabakh because they are ethnically Armenian, and in Nagorno-Karabakh, well, it used to be a part of Azerbaijan. And they did have a majority. They were about 70% ethnically Armenian or Karabakhi during its time as being a part of Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan was about 30%. So, you know, they did have that majority. Now it's 100%. And they do question that. You know, they question whether that's really good, how that looks for them to be, you know, 100%. Like, what is it? You know, people have said to me, "What does that say about us if nobody can live with us?" I mean, there's more reason than that it's 100%. You know, during that conflict, Azerbaijan, and I have to like slow down because I always say Abkhazia or Azerbaijan. Get all mixed up. So Azerbaijan, you know, they kicked out all the Armenians, and in Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh, they kicked out all the Azerbaijanis and they had a bit of a population swap, right? So, you know, that's why there's no more people left, no more Azerbaijanis in Nagorno-Karabakh. But they do wonder, like, what does that say about us? Nobody else can live with us, you know? And I think they do miss having that cultural exchange of having other people around, you know? Somebody that I spoke to in Nagorno-Karabakh, you know, they were expressing their sadness of missing their neighbors, of saying, you know, they said, my neighbor, you know, we borrowed sugar from them, they watched our kids, we watched their kids, they played together, and, you know, they were friends. It wasn't until later that they became an enemy, and then their friends still weren't really their enemy. They were just the wrong ethnicity, because now Nagorno-Karabakh is for Karabakhis. So, yeah. And so here too, this was in a, no, this is in the capital, Stepanakert. The Azerbaijani name is slipping my mind, so I'll be un-PC and just say Stepanakert. This is in Stepanakert as well. And it was cold. I went in the winter because I thought, oh, it'll be great. It'll be like look really cold and really depressing. And it was really cold and really depressing. It really was. I rented this apartment there, and it was like, yeah. Like if they had good heat, it would be a little nicer. But you know, it's totally landlocked. It's in the mountains. You know, getting oil for heating is like really hard, and they have to get it from Iran, and it's a tough way to go to be, you know, this a de facto state. You don't really have a lot of options, you know. This is in a church in the city Shushi, and this city used to be primarily Azerbaijani. And it used to be 30,000 people, and now it's 3,000 people. You know, and you go to a town like that, and you can really feel it's at that absence.
30,000 to 2,000?
To 3, yeah. You know, and I wanted to look at that. How does a state, you know, kind of protect its borders and find these images that speak to the military aspect or to the security aspect? Because that's one interesting thing, you know, it's interesting how these unrecognized countries, they do control their own borders, you know, and they're, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh is roughly the size of Delaware, you know, it's not tiny and insignificant. I saw this photo series of micro nations, and it's like, you know, an oil rig, and someone says, this is our country. It's like, that's, you know, they don't really have borders, they don't even have a population, you know, but these countries, they have populations and you know, large areas of land. And how do they secure those? So I looked for ways to kind of capture that sense of military, because obviously military is the first thing that a new country is going to establish, because, well, they needed it in order to become that new country. So it's very strong in those places. And this was during a memorial kind of commemoration. They opened up a new memorial, and the Minister of Defense was there, and it's a big to-do. And then a little bit of family life, potatoes and fish, yum. And this is a cemetery. This is an Abkhaz cemetery. You know, Nagorno-Karabakh won. They won because they have their own, you know, they control that land, and Azerbaijan doesn't. You know, they burned the cemeteries. They burned the villages that used to be Azeri. And you know, it's a pretty strong statement to make when you burn someone's cemeteries, and yeah, that's a sad thing. Just a good old laundry hanging. You know, they're war heroes, lost in the fight. Landmine removing. There was at the time, Nagorno-Karabakh had the largest amount of landmines per capita. And, you know, Afghanistan, like, way more landmines, but you know, not per capita, because the per capita is pretty small. It's like 200,000, 250,000. But they had a lot of landmines, and Azerbaijan wouldn't give over the maps to say where they are. So, you know, people were getting hit with, you know, relative frequency, because even though the week I was shooting this, somebody hit one, and you know, we lost a leg, and it's good that there are organizations like Halo Trust that, you know, that go and they do that, and Halo Trust was the largest employer in Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a really sad fact that the biggest employer is to remove the landmines. Getting ready to see the big Minister of Defense. Keeping warm. There's a lot of scavenging, pulling wood out of bombed out buildings. Here, just cardboard. Like I said, cold and depressing. I got what I wanted. The Nagorno-Karabakh flag. Pulling wood out of the buildings, yeah. These guys are scavenging. I had to leave a few days before I planned to. The Minister of Foreign Affairs asked me to leave. So
personally?
Yeah, I got called into the office and was like, you know, they asked when I was planning to leave, and I was like, in a few days, and they're like, maybe like tomorrow. So, you know, when they say you should probably go, you should probably just go. But, you know, I didn't think I was, like I said, I was just there to photograph what's happening, not to have any real slant on the matter. I'm not an advocate for their independence, nor am I a detractor. You know, I am my own thinking on self-determination and for these breakaway states is constantly changing. So I think at the time I was probably much more in favor of their independence, but then as I worked through this project, I kind of changed my mind a little bit, because I'm not sure it's all that pain is so worth that independence, or if maybe multiculturalism is worth fighting for more than self-determination. But maybe there's a point where one changes, where, you know, you cross this line from working for multiculturalism and it's clearly not working, and then self-determination is kind of the last resort. But it's easy to say here, because we have our own country, and these places have never had their own country. You know, they've either been in a empire, and then into the Soviet Union, and then into, you know, being joined with this republic they didn't want to be a part of. And then they come out and they're like, hey, we want to be our own country. And all of Europe is like, well, borders? What do we need those for? You know, this is Transdniester. This is the river, the Dniester River. A military parade in Transdniester. Transdniester is interesting how it's really used the nostalgia of the Soviet Union to its benefit to kind of make that part of its identity, whereas in other countries they've mostly moved away from that. But you know, on their flag is the hammer and sickle. It's still called the Supreme Soviet. Everything is very Soviet still.
So those Armenian soldiers?
This is in Transdniester. So these would be, well, ethnically Russian. Transdniester is ethnically Russian, as opposed to Moldova, from which they broke away, which are Moldovan and, you know, kind of Romanian. And then I was picked up. I got taken to police station right after this. And that was the first time to go to the police station, in the back of a Lada, and three people in the back seat of a Lada is way too many people in the back of the Lada, and way too cozy for my comfort. And this is in the main square in Transnistria, in Tiraspol. You know, and like I said, they still hold on to that iconography of the Soviet Union. And in Transnistria, it's really the only unrecognized country that I photographed that really isn't any semblance of a democracy. All the others, they do have some kind of elections of varying legitimacy. Surprisingly, Somaliland, has the most credible democracy, and they even have biometric voting, and they actually kind of do it right. But Transnistria is a little bit darker that way.
So I mean, just a general question, particularly about the, you know, these, the three you've discussed so far, Abkhazia, Transnistria, and Nagorno-Karabakh. You've been discussing them in terms of them being de facto states, countries that aspire to independence. To what extent do they really aspire to independence as opposed to aspire to being integrated into their, supporter state? So it would be Russia, obviously in the case of Transnistria, probably Abkhazia too, Armenia in the case of Nagorno-Karabakh. I mean, do they see the residents there talk in terms of, you know, we want to have our independent country, or we want to be part of Armenia?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I kind of thought some of that as well, but you know, talking to people, they were very adamant about, you know, not wanting to be part of, for instance, Armenia. People in Nagorno-Karabakh, they say, no, we're Karabakhi. I mean, they're like our, you know, we're all cousins. They're Armenians. We're ethnically Armenian too. You know, we speak the same language, the same religion, but we're Karabakhi, and we want this to be Nagorno-Karabakh as our own country. You know, they are tied to Armenia in a lot of ways for they don't get really assistance, but they are their only road to the rest of the world, the only place to, you know, fly anywhere. The only way to get things into the country are from Armenia. So they do need those relationships. And, you know, Armenia doesn't claim Nagorno-Karabakh as part of its own, but they also don't recognize them as their own country. You know, they don't necessarily say, well, yeah, you're really part of Azerbaijan. You know, they have this weird relationship.
I mean, they fought a war with Azerbaijan.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what a lot of people say. We didn't go through this effort, you know, we didn't go through all this bloodshed and all this, you know, trauma to just become a part of another country. You know, I think that would have happened, that probably would have happened if that were the real goal. And in Abkhazia, yeah, people don't really want to be a part of Russia. You know, I think there's a lot of, from what I got from people, you know, they don't want to be a part of Russia because Russia doesn't really have a great track record on any kind of, you know, supporting separatist movements or having, you know, they've been a part of Russia before. You know, they want their own country, and they're willing to wait it out for however long. I think, I don't think they'll ever get recognized by the broader international community. In the case of Abkhazia, I think it's more likely that they get absorbed into Russia, but I don't think that's a desire for very many people. But they might see it as the only way to not become part of Georgia again. So it's kind of a, you know, taking the least.
So I've read a little bit about Transnistria. I've read that it's like a very concentrated center of organized crime.
Yeah.
In Europe.
Yeah.
Did you see much of that when you were there with the evidence?
You know, it's like, to just your eye on the street, it's, you wouldn't really see that. I mean, you would be like, okay, these guys look kind of shady playing in the club. And I mean, I tried to make it look a little, you know, I'm looking for metaphors. I'm not trying to just shoot this from a, you know, matter of fact journalistic approach and say these are just guys here. I want this to allude to that organized crime there, because I'm not going to get into the underbelly of Transnistria arms dealing to warlords in Africa, because they do that. You know, Transnistria makes a lot of weapons that go into the black market, because those factories are still there from that time. And I mean, that's, I think, kind of known that they do it, but me personally seeing that, I did not get to. Farming. I wanted to see what rural life is like too. I just was in the dirt. Just in the dirt. Yeah. That old Soviet style. And then at this woman's house in the countryside, she was neighbors with this guy. And I stayed out here for a few days and just kind
of. The 16th year of their alleged independence?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. 16th year of independence for PMR.
When you showed pictures that showed the river, across the river, was that Romania then? Actual Romania? Or Moldova?
Moldova, yeah. And she had so much wine, this lady. We drank so much. And I woke up the next day sick as a dog. And although, like, all the pickled foods were really tasty, the wine wasn't as good as Moldova. But I didn't say that.
But the cognac's good.
The cognac is good, yeah, exactly. And of course Lenin, because like I said, they really hang on to that. And that's part of how I think the government in Transnistria kind of maintains itself and you know, it's really more of a fiefdom. The president and his family own like everything from the, you know, the big football club to the oil company, you know, the gas company to every store there, you know. And I think they're able to do that by evoking the, you know, that legacy of, or the, you know, the bygone times of the former, of the Soviet Union. So, yeah. I think that's it. That's it. So, any questions?
More questions, comments?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Apart from Gorokarabakh, do you think that a lot of these places could survive without support from Turkey or Russia or the Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because a lot of, you know, each place has its own situation, and very, you know, it's a unique situation where, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh, I think, gets the least amount of help, although they have a strong diaspora support in the U.S. The Armenian diaspora is really strong, and you know, whatever work gets done there, whether it's a new highway or a highway getting repaved, or a new school or church being built, that money comes from primarily the U.S. or from France, where there's also a large Armenian diaspora. So in Nagorno-Karabakh, they rely on the Armenian diaspora for a lot of help. In Abkhazia, they rely on their kind of proximity to Russia. There isn't much of a Abkhazian diaspora, so to speak. But so I think Abkhazia is, you know, but they're in a tougher situation like that, because they don't have a benefactor state like, for instance, Northern Cyprus. Northern Cyprus is like, they get a ton of aid from Turkey, and they have a new airport, they have new ports, they have Turkish companies that set up there. I mean, Turkey really battles a lot in Northern Cyprus, and that's really, I think, has made their reintegration with Cyprus, or their reunification, much more problematic, and I think that's why it hasn't happened, really. But they get all this aid, and otherwise they would be in probably a lot worse shape. Of the five, Somaliland really gets very, very little help. You know, they don't have any kind of big brother country kind of watching out for them, you know, like Abkhazia does. I don't think any of them are really particularly in good shape in terms of like getting any assistance. I don't think any, you know, they're as viable as they are. They exist right now, you know, without recognition too, which is, they're kind of defying logic in a way. Did that answer anything, or was that just rambling? And so,
sure.
No, I mean, what else?
I meant like economically, of course, but by having diplomatic cover by the state in the UN, or having built, like you call them, the peacekeepers in certain places, are they actually keeping peace, or are they just maintaining that frozen conflict?
Right. So, like in Abkhazia, they have that peacekeeping force there, which is Russian, right? So that doesn't really, I mean, it's keeping Russia maybe from, or I'm sorry, Georgia from trying to reclaim that land, but there's a lot of reasons why Georgia hasn't really tried to take back Abkhazia. You know, that's a large, it's a large territory. It's a lot of fighting to be done. What's keeping them from? You mean like what's keeping them from going, from getting taken over? I'm not sure I'm understanding. I'm sorry.
Like what's keeping it afloat? Like,
well, so I mean, I guess what is afloat? Like what? Like economically, they're not really afloat. They're just getting by day to day. You know, they're not flourishing in any way. None of these places are. So, yeah, I wouldn't say they're economically afloat. They're just existing. Yeah.
Yeah. I've read various references. Well, first of all, Moldova is supposed to be a big a source of human trafficking, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it said that supposedly the Russian mafia rules the Transnistria and various kinds of sort of suggestions that it's kind of a lawless place. Is your impression that, first of all, it is a lawless place, or is it just ordinary adult trap? Is there any of that that sort of surfaces in the place itself? Regardless what comes in and out of there?
Yeah, so, you know, like, personally, I haven't seen that, and it's, that wasn't a part of the project I wanted to put the time into. I've seen some really great photography projects that do look at the human trafficking in Moldova and Transnistria, and it is a big issue. I'm just not, and I think the government, you know, it is lawless in the way that the government can act and do with impunity. You know, it's organized crime, but the government is the organized crime, right?
So it's not really a on the street dangerous place where you're likely to get
exactly
held up or something like that.
Yeah, no, it's not a dangerous place like that. Like you can walk around Transnistria, any of these places, and feel pretty safe. not relatively safe. So it's, yeah, it's much more in the undercurrent. Yes.
Are you going to be extending this project to include the People's Republic of Luhansk and Donetsk, since they seem to be emerging in that similar sort of status of unrecognized states?
Well, you know, like I said in the beginning, when I started this, it was really about, and I don't know the situation of those places.
Still
involved, yeah.
That's one possible.
Right. So, you know, in the instance, well, one, I'm done with this. I'm not going. I'm done. Like, if Abkhazia becomes like the super wonderful resort place to go to, I'll go there. But in the meantime, these five, that's it. And these days too, it's hard to imagine another completely unrecognized country popping up again. Because in the meantime, since I started this, you know, Montenegro, you know, separated from Serbia, you know, through their referendum, they had a referendum that was part of their whole union in the beginning, that they could have this referendum and vote and decide. And they did that, and it went through just fine. And then Kosovo, you know, declared their independence, and within 24 hours, look how many countries recognize them. You know, not just Micronesian countries, but the US, Canada.
When are you going to Donbass?
What's that?
When are you going to the Donbass?
I'm not familiar.
Well, Ukraine.
Oh,
the same
thing. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That other candidate there.
Maybe
South Ossetia.
So South Ossetia was like, I thought about going to South Ossetia. And then I said, well, I've already got three former Soviet states, and one of which is Abkhazia. So am I going to really contribute much to this story? You know, that's why I also photograph Northern Cyprus, Somaliland, because it's a greater phenomenon than just the former Soviet Union, you know. Although it is interesting that, you know, Somaliland too broke away at the same time as these other places, you know, through different circumstances, of course. They had a long drawn out civil war from the 70s, you know, fighting the Said Bar dictatorship. Where's that going here? So another country, you know, Kosovo declares independence and they have all this recognition. South Sudan declares independence, right away they're being recognized. You know, so part of my fascination with this project and these places is that there's something about these places. They broke away at a time when nobody cared about recognizing them, you know. And it might be for different reasons. They don't have any resources. So who cares? South Sudan's got lots of resources. You know, they've got oil, right? They're gonna have some friends. You know, Somaliland doesn't. They're gonna have fewer friends. You know, Kosovo, you know, Europe and the US had a heavy emotional investment in that country. So they saw that through. They were invested there. In these places, there's no such investment. When Nagorno-Karabakh and Azerbaijan went to war, you know, who was paying attention? I was pretty young at the time, so I wasn't really, you know, up on my, you know, caucus news, but no, I don't think anybody really cared then. Because there were much greater things happening with the Soviet Union, and there were much bigger questions to be answered there. So now when there's countries that are seceding and successfully breaking away and controlling their own borders and then looking for that independence and the recognition of their sovereignty, you know, now we see those happening and they're getting recognized. But these ones, they break away at a time when nobody cared. Yeah.
You said that your perspective kind of changed throughout the project back and forth, whether it was worth it. After it's all done, did you end up on one side of the fence or the other?
No, I haven't. Because even you know, a couple months ago, my mind changed too, because I thought, well, like, this, you know, this kind of, for me, this project turned into a battle between self-determination and multiculturalism, and I realized that those two fundamental ideas that I had, both of which that I really believe strongly in, you know, I believe strongly that a group of people should have the right to govern themselves, you know, and I also believe in the strength of a multicultural society. You know, like, I, even just with Scotland, I thought, stronger together, yeah, that makes a lot of, like, yeah, we are stronger together, you know. And then just, more recently, I've realized, too, that you can only be stronger together if you really are together, if everybody in that society enjoys the same benefits of society. And, you know, even just watching what's happening in our country, it kind of brings those questions up for me. Like, if not everybody in our country is enjoying the same rights and privileges, you know, that's how they felt in Abkhazia too. And they came to this point of deciding that they needed to break away.
Maybe you ought to revisit the Nagorno-Karabakh thing, because people cared intensely at that time, and I think you might almost, that was the first, I don't know the metaphor, the first break in the Iron Curtain, or the first bricks out of the Soviet Union or whatever, and a million people changed residence over that particular conflict, so that was a pretty big deal.
It was. That's true.
People cared.
People did care, but in terms of government involvement, you know, there wasn't any, right? Like, people cared, and maybe they cared for different reasons too, because there could have been, you know, well, one, there is a large diaspora in the U.S. and in Europe, and a diaspora, a strong diaspora, is not to be reckoned with. You know, whereas the Abkhaz diaspora, well, no one's heard Abkhazia. So, you know, I say Abkhazia, and they think I'm taking the name out of a Harry Potter book. Yeah.
But did you, in talking to families or whatever, get the impression that there are a lot of people from those countries that are guest workers elsewhere sending money back that helps to support, maybe particularly Abkhazia and Transnistria?
So, not so much in Transnistria. More in Abkhazia, there are a lot of, there are some people who've left and they work in Turkey, for instance. In Somaliland, they do get a lot of remittances from family. But Somaliland is really the only place that I saw that as being such a big part of their economy. And they have so many money wiring places, and Somaliland got they got into a bit of a pinch after 9/11, and and the U.S. started changing the rules of wiring money, and this kind of more informal system that they use in Somalia, and they had to really reconfigure their whole system, because that was a really huge part of their economy.
What's it like getting a visa to an unrecognized state? Do you have to go to one of the countries that recognizes them and visit the consulate there, or just call? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah, so, well, like I said, when I started this, no country was recognized by any other country. Now only Abkhazia by three countries, four. So, you know, for instance, to get a visa to Abkhazia, I would email the Minister of Foreign Affairs and ask for permission, and they would send me a letter that then I would print and take to the border, and then I hope a lot, there's a lot of hoping here, because I wouldn't go through Russia, I would go through Georgia, because I didn't want the hassle of a Russian visa and doing all that. And I was living in Istanbul for part of this time, and it was only like 36 hours on the bus, you know, from Istanbul up through Georgia and then up to the border. And so I would go to the border, I would show them my letter, the Georgian military, they were like, whatever. They didn't really care that much, really. But then I would get to the Abkhaz side, and then there was a little bit more of a back and forth. On one trip, I had to wait until the next day at the border when they could talk to somebody. And then I would go to the capital with my letter, and then I would get a visa when I'm there. In Nagorno-Karabakh, there is a place to get a... in Armenia, in Yerevan, there's a place to get a visa for Nagorno-Karabakh. But if you ever plan to go to Azerbaijan, don't get them to put it in your passport, because then you can't go to Azerbaijan. And then in Somaliland, there's a place to get one in Ethiopia. So it's pretty, it's kind of a hassle, because they don't have a real consulate. And then when you're there, if something goes wrong, or God forbid you lose your passport, you're in a heap of trouble, because there's no one to call. But that's a risk that you kind of have to accept if you're going to go to a de facto state. Yeah.
You're quite unique, in my opinion, for being an American and visiting these unusual places. What was the reaction of people once they discovered you were an American? Did they greet you warmly? Were they hostile to you?
No, I've always been greeted warmly in any place I've been, for the most part. And I've done a lot of traveling beyond these five places too, but it's always more of a curiosity, just why am I there, or what, they think that they're kind of a center of the universe too, each place, so they think everybody's heard of Nagorno-Karabakh, and Abkhazia and stuff, so yeah, they're kind of excited that somebody's there to give them a little extra attention. So, yeah.
Well, questions, comments, final thoughts?
I'm just curious, and I'm sure you could answer it, but why Russia hasn't attempted to develop Abkhazia, restore it, a resort, and attract the people for Russians to visit and the like?
To kind of take over Abkhazia?
Well, without necessarily politically absorbing it, nevertheless providing aid, so allow it to restore its status as a resort that would be attractive to Russian tourists.
Yeah, I think partly is that Russia might, I could imagine, I don't know for sure, but I could imagine that Russia would rather promote, say, Sochi and that area to be, if you're going to go on vacation somewhere subtropical in Russia, go to Sochi, don't go to Sukhumi. I don't know if they would want to put the money into that, because that would be a lot. And then on the political side, I think, they started the legwork of absorbing it when they start giving out passports, and then when something comes up with Georgia again, they could say, well, we're just protecting our citizens. Look at all the people in Abkhazia that have, that are passport holders. I think there's now. When I was there, it was around 100,000.
Some uncertainty as to the future.
Yeah.
Status of Abkhazia.
Yeah. I think it will be more difficult for Russia, and I think they haven't perhaps done more, because Georgia and the NATO are getting closer and closer, and I think that's becoming an issue maybe for them. But I don't know. I'm not an academic. Yeah.
What was the primary currency?
So each place, some places have their own currency. In Transnistria, they make their own ruble. They have a Transnistrian ruble, which is worth like absolutely nothing. It's a pretty sad currency. So they have their own. In Somaliland, they have their own too, a Somaliland shilling, and there will be. I didn't show pictures from there because you guys are Krika, so we stay Krika, but they would have piles of money because it would just take so many bills to make you know, a dollar. You know, if it's 20,000 shillings to a dollar, and the largest denomination they have is a 500, you know, it's like money changers are on the street with, like, you know, just huge piles of money. You see them walking with wheelbarrows, you know. But then in Nagorno-Karabakh, they use the Armenian currency. And in Abkhazia, they use a ruble, the Russian ruble. Yeah, and then Northern Cyprus uses the Turkish lira. Yeah, it kind of keeps things easier for them, since, you know, Abkhazia is going to go, they're getting all their goods from Russia,